Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thank you so much for being here with us on this Thursday afternoon or Thursday evening or maybe even Friday morning, wherever, depending on where you are. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest for both hours today is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and it's going to be an open forum. So you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you don't know how open forum works, it's just open. You can call, ask whatever you like, and you don't have to be Catholic to call. You can call and ask anything you want to know about the Catholic Church, about maybe you have a philosophical or a moral question. Maybe you want to know particularly about the person of Jesus, or maybe you have a wider, more general question. They're all welcome when Jimmy's here. 888-318-7884. Hello, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
How are you?
Catholic Answers Live radio host.
Thank you. I was waiting for my title to be inserted in there.
Yeah.
Can you believe it? We have weather, Jimmy. It's raining.
It is. Water is falling from the sky.
I haven't seen weather here for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of nice.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't looking forward to it.
Unless you're the Wicked Witch of the West East.
Yeah. I never understood how exactly they came to be so vulnerable to water. Is that described anywhere?
I don't know. I haven't read the Oz novels, but I don't know. Maybe they're from that same planet that the aliens came from in Mel Gibson's movie Signs.
Oh, were they? I forgot that. They were sensitive to water?
Yeah, rain kind of hampered their invasion.
Kind of rained on their parade a little bit?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
And there's a great scene in Stargate SG-1 where the team is exercising in a gym and they're talking about some movie they've all just seen.
Oh.
And one of them is commenting, if water kills them, why did they come to a planet that's 70% covered in it?
Like, these are not the brightest aliens.
Yeah.
Our number is 888-318-7884. The phones usually fill up and stay pretty full for Jimmy. So go ahead and dial 888-318-7884. Jimmy's the author of quite a few books, including The Drama of Salvation, Why We're Catholic. Excuse me, not Why We're Catholic. The Bible is a Catholic book. I don't know why I do that sometimes.
To err is human?
And yes, and so I'm going to ask you to be divine.
Okay.
Thank you. The one I was thinking of is A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. And also, he's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What drops tomorrow, Jimmy?
Tomorrow is the 80th. Well, this week is the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks.
Oh, yeah.
And so we have the first part of a two-part look at whether there was a conspiracy involved in Pearl Harbor. There have been many charges made about Pearl Harbor that kind of mirror some of those about 9/11, like it was an inside job, and
right.
Or at least the government knew about it and deliberately let it happen anyway. And also like 9/11, there's theories about, well, maybe there were foreign agents at work other than the people who did the attacks that led to it.
So you're going to cover all that?
So I'm going to cover all that. And very few people have arrived at the conclusion that the evidence ultimately points to.
Oh, okay, good.
So you may think you know. FDR totally knew or totally did it or something like that. Well, the truth is out there, but it's more complex than you might suppose.
So Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops on Fridays. There are just dozens and dozens of episodes this week on Pearl Harbor. You just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. The internet will get you there, that old helpful internet. Up first today, Grant in St. Petersburg, Florida, watching on YouTube. Grant, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, hi, fellas. My question is regarding marriage, and me and my wife have a difference of opinion on this question. From a Catholic perspective, is there a maximum age difference that is allowed for a Catholic marriage?
Age difference? You mean differential between the ages of the two spouses?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
No, canon law doesn't have any provision like that. It does require that that there is a minimum age for the spouses before they can get married. But then, if they're both above that age, there's no canonical requirement that they only be separated by a certain number of years. Having said that, that's the state of the law, as a, but common sense also governs these things in addition to the what is explicitly stated in the law. And although there is no intrinsic reason why there couldn't be a very large age differential between spouses, common sense would suggest that it's not a great idea in many situations if, you know, someone is 70 years older than the other. But having said that, there could be situations where having one party who's 70 years older than the other could make sense. So it's not intrinsic to the nature of the situation.
Okay, Grant?
Okay, yes. Thank you for clearing that up for me. By the way, I won that argument. So thank you, Jimmy.
Okay. All right. What did she say the age difference limit would be?
Well, she had a couple of opinions. She said a man who loses his wife, if that man had children, he should not marry anybody who is the same age or younger than his children.
Well, that may be prudent,
That would be a matter of prudence, and in many situations that might be advisable because it could cause some awkward, weird situations and potential resentment with the kids and the stepmother.
Grant, thank you very much for getting us started. Appreciate the call and the question. Line's lighting up, so I'm going to keep moving. Fred in Canada, watching on Twitch, is next. Hi, Fred.
Hi, my question is Matthew 23, the beginning there. Jesus mentions scribes and Pharisees, they sit on the seat of Moses, so you have to do whatever they say. My question is, are these people who are prior to the new covenant, these are Jews who are teaching the old covenant and scriptures correctly? And do we know who any of these people were? Like, was Philo of Alexandria one of them? And if we went further back in time, was Judas Maccabeus one? Was Onias the third one? Do we know who these people were?
So we do know who some individual Pharisees were because they're mentioned in the New Testament and in a few other sources. I'm sure Josephus mentions a few Pharisees by name. But basically, the Pharisees are a school of thought that arose in Judaism. And they're not referred to in the Old Testament, and they seem to have arisen and gained prominence to the point that they would get mentioned after the time of the Maccabean Revolution. And they gained prominence and became influential quite early, quite soon after that. The Jewish historian Josephus mentions, for example, that during the time of Queen Alexandra, who reigned after the initial Maccabean Revolution but before the New Testament, that the Pharisees were so influential with her that they effectively had the power of binding and loosing, meaning that whatever policies they recommended become law, she was willing to enact. So they exercised this power through Queen Alexandra. The scribes is more of a profession than a school of thought. Scribes were people who were educated in reading and writing, and because of that, they were familiar with the law of Moses and would offer opinions on it, kind of like attorneys offer opinions about law and how it should be interpreted and applied. And that's basically what the scribes did. And then the Pharisees were a particular school of thought that held certain views and often worked in conjunction with the scribes. But basically, what they're doing when Jesus says they sit on the seat of Moses is they're interpreting and applying the Mosaic law to their own day.
Okay, Fred?
Were they applying Mosaic law correctly?
Well, in some matters, yes. In other matters, no. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, has a critique of some of the applications that were being made. Like it says to love your neighbor, but it's okay to hate your enemy. And he says, no, that's not the case. Or they would sometimes limit observance of the law to external matters. Like it's as long as you don't physically commit adultery, you can do whatever you want in your mind. And Jesus says, no, that's not acceptable. Principles of the law apply internally as well as externally. So they weren't always doing it correctly. This is sometimes, I've sometimes heard people suggest, well, this is kind of, they had some kind of infallibility and they didn't. You know, mm-hmm. Jesus makes that clear. All he's really saying when he says, do whatever they tell you, is, well, these guys are the effective lawmakers for the community, so obey the law. You know, he says they don't keep it themselves. They're hypocrites. But if something's been established as this is the law for the community, well, then obey the law. At least that's the general rule. Now, there can be situations where they would require something contrary to fundamental morality, like when we see in Acts, early in Acts, the Sanhedrin tells the apostles to stop preaching the name of Jesus, and they say, well, we must obey God rather than men, so we're not going to do that. And so Jesus is really just saying, look, these guys are the lawmakers, so do what they tell you. He's not covering, are they always right, or what do you do if they have a mistaken ruling? Obviously, you're either not bound or should disobey in those cases. He's just establishing a general principle, and we really shouldn't try to read too much more into it than that.
Fred, thanks. I got to go to a break now, but thank you very much for the call. There will be momentarily two lines open. You are welcome to call. It's open forum, 888-318-7884. Open forum is not limited to Catholics who have questions about the Catholic faith. Anybody can call. If you got a question, we'd be happy to do our very best to get you an answer. 888-318-7884. And before I send you off to the break, my book, A Teacher of Strange Things, on sale for $10 a copy today until 6 p.m. And that's what it says there. Oh, it also says 19.
What time zone?
19 Pacific. It says 19 other books are also on sale for
$10. That's like 3 hours from now.
It's yes, just 3 hours from now.
Okay.
Yes.
So act now.
I guess
ending
this is,
soon.
This is a real act now. But that's the way Carrie set it up. So it says, what are you waiting for on the ad? Yeah, don't wait. 20 books, some of our best-selling titles, some of our most popular titles, each one of them only $10 for the next 3 hours at shop.catholic.com.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Each week on The World Over, Raymond Arroyo challenges listeners and viewers with important political and cultural reporting and analysis of a wide variety of topics of interest to Catholics and people of faith. And you can get news from The World Over in your inbox every week. It's easy. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. In the midst of the Advent season, a very happy Advent to you and all of yours as we make our way towards Christmas. Beth in San Antonio, Texas is next, listening on 89.7 KJMA. Glad to have you, Beth. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I was wondering if there was any church teaching about loved ones visiting us in our dreams after they pass. Or even just saints, and mm-hmm. if there's anything in the Bible that points to that.
Well, so it's certainly church teaching that God can allow the saints to manifest to us, either in dreams or in other ways, and the church even okay. has a process for investigating claims that that happens, although it tends not to apply it in situations where someone just says, like, my grandmother came to me in a dream and said she was okay.
Yeah,
you know, it tends to be, if it's more involved than that, that the actual investigation would be done. And we do see things like this happening in the Bible. In 2 Maccabees, there's an occasion where Judah Maccabee is fighting in his rebellion. And in a vision he has in a dream at night, the deceased high priest Onias and the deceased prophet Jeremiah both appear to him and speak to him to encourage him to keep fighting for God's cause. There are also loads of reports of this happening to people in real life. This is a very common phenomenon, and it's actually something lots and lots of people have happened. Sometimes it has a purely naturalistic cause. After my wife died, I had a lot of dreams for a long time where I would dream not just that I was encountering her, but that she had like died, but then somehow gotten better.
Oh, yeah.
And when I would raise this point with her in a dream, she wouldn't want to talk about it because that would shatter the illusion of me getting to be with her again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that gave me reason to believe in my own case that this was a natural phenomenon that was occurring, that it was a kind of subconscious wish fulfillment of being reunited with her.
Yeah.
But if she had done something else... Like if she had said, yes, you're right, I did die, and I'm better now because I'm in heaven, and here's what's going to happen next week.
Yeah, right.
That would give me strong evidence that it wasn't merely natural. So in a lot of cases, it's ambiguous. It's not clear one way or the other, but I would take such visitations for what they are and you know, signs of love, and whether they have natural or supernatural causes in a particular case, I would leave up to God and just be thankful to have the chance to encounter a loved one again.
What do you think, Beth?
I suggested that as part of a prayer group that's like non-denominational and try not to bring up theology, but sometimes people do every once in a while. And so I just needed, unfortunately, all these people are Protestants and the Maccabees aren't in their Bibles. But
yeah.
I like some of the other stuff you said, so I'll just put that in there.
Okay, Beth, thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. It's open forum. You can call with any question you like. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The number is 888-318-7884. Up next is Eric in Minnesota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Eric, we're glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I watched a video between you and Jordan B. Cooper a while back.
Lutheran pastor, yeah.
I guess I was wondering... between that, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the ILC, and it was one of the pontifical, it was a Catholic group from the office of the Pope, and the International Lutheran Council, they were doing, they were having some conversations, and I guess, like, with that, and you having talked with Jordan B. Cooper, I was wondering if you see an actual path going forward for reunification of like confessional Lutherans with the Catholic Church?
Well, I do, but I don't know whether it will happen before the second coming, and I don't expect it to happen in our lifetimes. In order for us to be able to get back together, I mean, there was kind of a hope on the part of some that some people were talking about, including Joseph Ratzinger, after the Second Vatican Council, of maybe there was a way to visibly reunite with confessional Lutherans where we would agree that, okay, if you interpret the Augsburg Confession, which is a Lutheran confessional document, if you interpret that confession in a way that's acceptable to, that's compatible with the Catholic faith, then maybe we could reunite on that basis. And even if they didn't share all Catholic beliefs, as long as they shared these beliefs in a way that was compatible with the Catholic faith, then maybe we could reunite. And it was ultimately concluded that that wasn't the way to go, because in order to have real full union, you need to have union. This is the reasoning, that you need to have not just agreement on a certain set of beliefs, but you need to have full unity in the faith, not just on certain points of faith. And so as a result, that was viewed or came to be viewed as an impractical suggestion. And that seems to be the path that the church has been following since, that in order to achieve full visible union, we need to have full union in the faith. And that's something I don't foresee happening in our own lifetimes between confessional Lutheranism and Catholicism. I think that we're on a trajectory that could lead to that at some future date, perhaps centuries from now, perhaps not so many centuries from now, because the churches have been on, broadly speaking, a path of reconciliation and looking at each other more favorably and clearing away old confusions. And there's been a lot of work done on that, but we haven't gotten to the point where we have full union in the faith yet.
Okay, Eric?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate the call. Open forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Up next, Darrell in Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks, Darrell, for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks a lot, guys, for taking my call. I really appreciate the app. There's like a ton of just great stuff on there.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks a lot for that question that the lady asked about dreams. It was actually right on time. My question is rather very different from that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going about to work? I visit a lot of homes on a daily basis doing service and installation, things like that. And I just notice certain things. And I may meet people who are Hindus or Muslims or other religions, and I may see that they're very devoted in certain rituals and practices. They're very serious about doing a lot of things, and they're very nice people, outwardly at least. And what about their salvation? I mean, they're very serious about their spirituality. I wonder about their salvation. What does the church say about other people of other religions, and they're just trying to seek God out and trying to, in their own understanding.
Okay.
Right. So this is something that the Second Vatican Council talked about, and if you want to look up what it has to say, it's in a document called Lumen Gentium, and it's sometimes called the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church, but if you just type in Dogmatic Constitution of the Church or Lumen Gentium, it'll come up. You want to look around, it's around paragraph 16 or section 16 in that document, plus or minus a few. But in essence, the Church holds that all salvation comes through faith and comes through Jesus Christ. And the ordinary way of receiving salvation is through faith in Christ. But if people don't have faith in Christ through no fault of their own, you know, like maybe they were raised in a different culture or a different religion, mm-hmm. and this is what they've been taught, and they did what children are supposed to do, which is listen to what their elders tell them,
right.
then they wouldn't be Christian through no fault of their own. And if they otherwise seek to do what they should and cooperate with God's grace as they receive it, like being loving people and trying to be sincere in their practice of faith, and you know they're avoiding mortal sin and things like that, then they're not putting a barrier in the way of God's grace reaching them. And so it would be possible for them to be saved through Jesus Christ, even though they won't realize in this life that it's through Jesus that they've actually been saved.
Does that make sense to you, Darrell?
I see. Yes, definitely. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, Darrell, if you want to hang on, I'd love to send you a copy of one of Jimmy's books called The Drama of Salvation. You're welcome to it if you'd like it. Just stay on the line, and they'll get your address and send it down to Texas. And hope maybe we'll speak again. Thank you, Darrell.
Yeah.
Let's go to Chuck in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on 540 AM. Chuck, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good evening. It's Christmas time, and I'm trying to really get closer back to my church and Jesus.
Praise God.
I was just wondering, I can't find anything really that tells me how we came to the name of Jesus Christ, since he was referred to as Emmanuel at one point in the Bible.
Hmm.
And he obviously had a stepfather, a human father, Joseph, mm-hmm. and a mother who had a maiden name, and I can't find anything that leads me to how Jesus Christ, the name, came to evolve to what we know today.
Okay. Well, so Emmanuel is a Hebrew word or term that means God is with us. And that was applied prophetically to Jesus because he is literally God. And when he became incarnated, he literally was God with us. So that's the sense in which he's called Emmanuel. It wasn't that that would be his actual name. It was more a prophecy of what he would be. Then before Jesus was born, angels appeared to Mary and Joseph and told them to name the child Jesus, which was a common name. It's the same name in Aramaic and in Hebrew as the name Joshua. They both go back. They're both the same in those languages. And it means Yahweh saves, or Yahweh is salvation, which also communicates Jesus's role, not just as God, the way Emmanuel does, but his role as our Savior. In Aramaic, the term for his name would, depending on the dialect and the accent, would have been pronounced something like Yeshua. And then that got passed into Greek as Jesus, because Greek wants to adjust the name a little bit when it comes into Greek. And then from Jesus, it went into Latin as Jesus, because Latin wants to adjust. And then we got it in English from Latin as Jesus, because English likes to adjust. And so that's how we got the name Jesus. And then Christ is from the Greek word Christos, which means anointed one or Messiah or Christ. And that's treated kind of like a name, even though it's really his title.
Chuck, we got to take a break. Thank you very, very much for the call and for the question. And we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
This is Debbie Giorgiani.
And I'm Jerry Usher.
Join us for Take Two with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow at noon Eastern.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Way to go, Darren. A little bit of groovy Advent music. Advent groovy music. Same as the regular groovy music. Advent groovy music. Thanks for playing
but it
that.
It has a more Advent-y feel
everything
when you play it in Advent.
Ever since we put that tree up. Did you see
it? Oh, you've got a little Charlie Brown tree there.
Yes.
Nice.
It's very impressive. We haven't got the stockings up yet, though. We got to get stockings.
You know, in the old days, when the studio was located in a different part of the building,
yeah,
and it was much smaller and nowhere near as cool as the current studio.
This is very cool.
We had all the radio people in the same hallway as the old studio, and every year the radio people would decorate that hallway.
Oh, yeah.
So that it became, and this was a lot of this was before you came
yeah.
as host.
Yeah.
But they would decorate it every year, and it was intense. And I mean, it was like oppressively Christmassy. And I was always anxious every year to see and would encourage them to make it even more oppressively Christmassy than ever.
Yeah. Well, what happened to our Christmas decorations? Did they get lost in the recent moves, Darren? Oh, they're in a box in your office. Okay. Because we got to get them up. Because I noticed that only one department has their Christmas decorations or their Advent decorations up so far. And it's the ladies. They have theirs up. So, all right, we'll try to get oppressively
Christmassy.
That's what
good.
We're going for.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Tim in Wyoming, watching on Facebook Live. Tim, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that Lucifer was in heaven, he was supposed to be the second most powerful being in the universe. And so it doesn't make sense to me how Saint Michael would be more powerful and able to throw him down from heaven into hell or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work exactly? How is Saint Michael that strong?
Well, I can think of several ways. The first way is to actually devote a little attention to the premise of the argument, which is that Lucifer is the second most powerful, or I should say Satan, because Lucifer is not actually called Lucifer in the Bible. Mm-hmm. That's a name that was given to him later. If Satan, was he the most powerful, second most powerful being, or the most powerful creature, put it that way?
Right.
Was he? How do we know that? Now, we can infer from things that we learn in the Bible that he's very powerful, but is he actually the most powerful of the angels? Well, I don't have a way of establishing that. That's not a matter of church teaching. That's not something that's taught in the Bible. I know there are people who have speculated about that down through the centuries, and I can see why it might be natural to assume that, but I don't actually have any proof of that. And so I don't, in fact, know that there was a most powerful creature. Even if Satan's on the top rung of powerful creatures,
right?
Maybe there's more than one on that level. Maybe it's, you know, maybe Michael is also on that top rung, because we also know that Michael is a very powerful angel. He's referred to as one of the chief princes in the book of Daniel. And so he's a very high-ranking angel too. Presumably that goes along with a lot of power. And so he's also involved in key events, in the history of the world, and that suggests he's very powerful. And so maybe there's not a single angel that's the most powerful. Maybe there's a group that are equally powerful, and the devil and Lucifer happen to be in that group. Or maybe Lucifer, or I keep saying that, maybe Satan is just a powerful angel, but maybe he's not on the top rung. Maybe there are other angels that are more powerful than Lucifer, in which case Michael might be one of those. Or even if the devil is more powerful innately than Michael, well, God can give him whatever help he needs. You know, that help can take a variety of forms. I mean, if you play video games or watch anime or something like that, you're going to see characters power up at times, whether it's taking a pill or engaging the power of the Dragon Ball or, you know, whatever it may be. And God can give Michael the boost in power he needs, because God's got infinite power. So God can give some whatever power to Michael that Michael needs to defeat the devil. Intrinsically, he could do that by giving him extra angelic strength, or he could do it in another way by giving Michael assistance to help him in battle in the form of other angels. Uh-huh. So even though Michael may be the leader of the angelic action against the devil, he may not be the only angel participating. And in fact, we even see an example of that in the book of Daniel, where Daniel has been praying for 3 weeks. God has heard his prayer. And then Gabriel shows up and says, hey, I got your message 3 weeks ago. I've been delayed by the demonic prince of Persia. And he and I were fighting. And then Michael came, and Michael's kind of got him in a headlock right now. And that's how I got through the lines to tell you this message I'm about to give you. And then I'm going to go back, and Michael and I are going to kick his tuchus, and he's going to be taken out of the running, and then the demonic prince of Greece is going to gain prominence. So we see there Gabriel and Michael, and perhaps other angels acting under their authority, engaging in a kind of joint military action against the devil. And that might be what's happening when Michael defeats the devil.
Okay, Tim?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you, because I had not been introduced to the idea of angelic power-ups before. Now I
The
only video game I'm really familiar with is Mario Kart.
Uh-huh.
And they have power-ups in that.
Yeah.
So I can see, like, the devil just driving over, or
and
Michael
cartoons Gordon. Are another place where you see that. And not just anime.
Oh, yeah.
Cartoons.
Popeye got a power-up.
Well, Popeye got a power-up. I was also thinking of Underdog.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
He had the pill he would take. And so, yeah, you have lots of situations where, and it's in live action too. You know, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, or before them, Ultraman would power up as well.
I love Ultraman. When I was a kid, I loved Ultraman. But
almost no one today knows about Ultraman.
I know. He kind of fell out of it. Well, I don't know how many know about Underdog either, but I always felt like his feelings for Sweet Polly Purebred were more than she deserved. I just didn't see it.
She was worthy of Underdog?
No. I thought Underdog was much cooler than Sweet Polly Purebred.
Well, she was purebred, though.
It was just
good
my
breeding.
Feeling at the time, Jimmy. That's all I can tell you.
Uh-huh.
Patrick in Mississippi, listening on Biloxi Radio. You are up next, Patrick. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, I'm listening, Biloxi, but I'm tuned into a radio station in the southeastern Louisiana area, of which there's also several megachurch pastors in that area that occasionally I will stop on some of their TV stations. And I will say that they're ignorant of Catholicism and not very fond of it. So I'm curious, have you ever had a mind to, or have you ever been invited to go on one of their television shows and just go head to head and maybe debate or educate them about how they're so wrong on some of the things that they espouse?
Yeah, I've appeared on a variety of non-Catholic radio and television shows, including people of different faith backgrounds, including in the Protestant world. And, you know, sometimes they'll invite you on and sometimes they'll treat you fair. And I'm happy to go on such things. So if you are interested in having me appear on a local program, feel free to suggest it to the people on the local programs that you listen to. I'd be more than happy to appear and talk with people about stuff. I do it in a charitable way, but, you know, there are a lot of misconceptions that need to be corrected, and I'm happy to do that. And if you or anybody else who would like to get me on a radio show in their area would broker the contact with the local radio hosts, that would be great. And you can always reach me at jimmy@catholic.com. And it's better if they're local listeners. Contact them. And sometimes people will say, hey, why don't you, Jimmy Akin, contact these people?
Right.
Well, because
they're like, who's
this guy? Why does he want to come on? But if their own listeners are telling them, hey, there's this Catholic guy, he would be really good on your show, and here's his email address, please consider him, that'll have more success than if I try to batter on my own way onto their show.
Okay, Patrick?
Yeah, and I hope they would be fair and kind to you. And I wonder, is a good comeback or argument to anyone who follows sola scriptura just to say, well, that's just your opinion, and my opinion is different, and why don't we just leave it at that?
It's a response, and it's a perfectly acceptable response, because you may not have time to discuss the issue further, or it may not be convenient to discuss the issue further, and that's fine. It doesn't disprove sola scriptura, but you're not obligated to discuss a topic with someone just because they would like to discuss it right now. You can have other things going on, and it may not be the right time to discuss it, or it might be better for someone else to discuss it. So, yeah, you can certainly say on anything, not just sola scriptura, well, I understand that's your belief, and I respect that. My own beliefs are different, but I need to do this other thing now, or let's do this other thing now.
Patrick, thanks. I really, really appreciate that, and I hope that folks will take Jimmy up on that idea of maybe seeing if there's folks that'd like to have them on their shows, whether TV or radio. Hey, there's a growing awareness all across North America that we have.
Do you have statistical evidence of that?
I do.
Has there been a sociological study that it's actually growing across America?
Across America,
not,
Canada,
not just
as well.
Locally somewhere.
All the evidence I have, I believe, is anecdotal.
Okay.
So that's all I've got.
Non-statistical anecdotal evidence.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Just so we
but
know,
I think it's
you haven't done a randomized controlled double-blind study.
I was going to, and then I forgot. I got doing something else this afternoon, I completely forgot to do my... What kind of study was it? Randomized?
Randomized, controlled double-blind.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was going to do. Okay. I thought about doing triple-blind even. That's how
there
committed
are,
I am
There are
this,
triple-blind studies.
Really?
And quintuple. In fact, in the parapsychological community, because parapsychologists know they're going to encounter a bunch of pushback on their studies.
Oh, yeah.
They actually will do like quintuple blind studies where nobody involved in the project has the complete picture.
Oh.
And actually skeptics, materialist skeptics like Ray Hyman have said, do not poo-poo parapsychological studies. They are among the best designed in the world.
Yeah, because they know they got to.
They've got to be, yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to be my, I'm going to do at least a quadruple blind study of my fact. That
Tell us your fact.
That there's a growing awareness that Our Lady of Guadalupe is not just the patroness of Mexico, but of all the Americas. And we celebrate her feast day. We're going to do a little bit of a celebration here on the 11th, not the 12th. Mm-hmm. And Cardinal Raymond Burke will be offering a pontifical high mass at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Wisconsin, in La Crosse, Wisconsin. But we're going to be streaming it online. We'll have Father Hugh here in the studio, and we'll do he'll be explaining certain parts of the Mass. And it's, you know, with the cardinal vesting, and then do they call it devesting or unvesting at the end? I don't. But all these things that many you may not have seen before in a Mass, Father will be providing some play-by-play. I'll be here in the studio with him. You can join us at Catholic.com. At 11 a.m. Central, that would be noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Saturday morning for a pontifical high mass in honor of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
And it's also the first public mass that Cardinal Burke has performed since he recovered from COVID.
Thank you, Jimmy. I didn't even realize that. All right, so join us. If you got the time, you know where to find us, Catholic.com.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
This is Raul Garo, founder of the JP2 Catholic Radio Network. Catholic Radio promotes the sense of the personal encounter. The type of encounter found between a radio host and callers helps to soften up the heart and open it up to receive the word, which is the good news. As a result, hearts are transformed and lives are saved because of Catholic Radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio. Now, more than ever.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm not really prepared to go back. I was working on my quintuple blind study.
Well, after it gets to a certain point, they just start calling them multi-blind.
Multi-blind study? Oh, yeah. Let's go to Betsy in Portland, Oregon, listening on KBBM Catholic Radio. So happy to have you, Betsy. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm so glad to be able to ask you this. In the Bible, Jesus is talking to people, and he draws a line in the dirt, but he doesn't say anything. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we... that you can tell me about what lessons he might be trying to teach us in that action that he takes.
So this...
I won't tell you about how it relates to something that I'm going through, and I have an idea, but I just want to hear what you have to say, because I don't know what's going on. Yeah.
And I want to compliment you, Betsy, for keeping me blind to the context, because that way I can give you just a straight, direct answer that won't be influenced by anything you might say. Sometimes people will call on the show and they'll say, here's what some other Catholic figure that you knew said about something.
Yeah, right.
And I don't, and what do you think? And it's like, well, I don't know if they said that or if it's been some, there's been garbled a little bit in transmission, so I can't really comment on what they said. All I can comment on is what you said.
Yeah.
I also rigorously avoid let's you and him fight situations.
Oh, come on, Jimmy.
The quickest way to get me to minimize my response is to portray it as let's you and him fight.
What kind of conflict can we have here? Yeah.
But in Betsy's case, so the story that you're referring to is found in the Gospel of John, and specifically it's found in the story of the woman caught in adultery, which is like it's part of a fragment that starts at the end of John 7 and continues into John 8. And what's happening in this story is there are these people who have caught a woman in the act of adultery, and they've brought her before Jesus, and they're talking about her, and they're kind of trying to get Jesus into a let's you and them fight situation because they want him to condemn her,
right,
and they're ready to stone her. And so they're trying to pull him into a conflict that is not his own. And as they're talking about all this, John says, not that he drew a line in the dirt, but that he was writing in the dirt with his finger. Now, that could be a line, that could be a doodle, it could be a word or something like that. We don't really know. It's fascinating, but he does use the word for write, even though you could maybe interpret that as drawing. But this is the only time we have Jesus referred to as writing anything, and we're not told what it is.
Right.
Now, I'm sure because people have picked over the Gospels and tried to find significance in every little detail, you know, like it's teaching some spiritual lesson. And that can be valid, not necessarily in the literal sense of the text of what was John trying to communicate with us, but maybe there are deeper meanings that even John wasn't aware of. You know, it's legitimate to explore those thoughts. But in terms of what was John trying to teach us, the human author, I don't know that he was trying to particularly teach us anything more than Jesus wasn't really impressed by what these people were saying. He wasn't even, until they asked him a direct question, he like really wasn't even paying much attention to them, because what they were saying about condemning this woman really wasn't worthy
of his attention. Oh.
And so he's just occupying his time by doing some writing or doodling or drawing in the dirt. And I don't know that it has, on the literal level, any particular significance beyond that. Now, on the spiritual level, you can speculate all kinds of things. But one of the things you need to do if you do engage in spiritual level speculations is about what could be buried in the text that is not part of the human author's intention, is you need to, number one, keep the speculation in check. Number two, it needs to be plausible, a plausible speculation. Number three, it needs to not contradict other things we know. And number four, we need to realize it's just speculation about what could be there, not proof of something. Because if it was something God meant to be important and provable and something we would use in a proof, he would have put it in the text itself in the literal sense, not in an extended sense like the spiritual sense.
Betsy, what do you think?
Well, I think that makes very good sense. And I will say that growing up as a Protestant is where I got the idea that he had drawn a line somehow. Maybe that's how I read it or understood it. So anyway, that's very helpful. Now I can just go somewhere else and look for my answer. It's not in Jesus drawing a line and saying, okay, well, don't cross the line, which is what I was kind of trying to find out about.
Oh, yeah.
So that thank you.
If you want something Jesus says about not crossing lines, it's not exactly that image, but he does say seek the narrow way as opposed to taking the broad and easy way that leads to destruction. Seek the narrow way. And obviously, if you're treading a narrow path, you're not crossing the lines that mark the edge of the path. So you could kind of apply that to that concept.
Right. Well, there are lines that have come up in my life, and I can't do anything to cross that line. And maybe that's what it is. And that makes me feel good that, yes, I just won't worry. I just won't cross that line.
Well,
so,
Betsy,
thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. It's open forum. Anybody's welcome to call. Any question at all, 888-318-7884. Going to Braintree, Massachusetts. Paul in Braintree listening on the EWTN app. Glad to have you, Paul. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, yes, good evening. Jimmy, my question is, when a blessing is bestowed upon an individual or by the congregation, by a priest, it's the priest gives, makes a sign of the cross in the name of the Father in one motion and straight ahead. Mm-hmm. When a bishop bestows a blessing on you, it's a three-tiered blessing. He says Father and on the right, that makes a sign of the cross in the middle, the Son, the Holy Spirit. A lot of people don't recognize that, but I was wondering, what are the origins of that? Is it some canonical fiat in the church, and then what is the significance of it? If you can just discuss that, I would appreciate it.
Well, this isn't something that I've studied, so I'd have to actually like go and check the Roman Pontifical, which is the book that deals with bishops. It's also sometimes also called the Ceremonial of Bishops. I'd have to go check that and see, does it prescribe this? I don't think the Book of Blessings discusses this. I would have to go and see, is it rooted in the actual law, or could it be just a custom that some bishops may be doing on their own? But assuming it is rooted in the law, I would assume that the reason for it is that since bishops rank higher than priests, it's considered fitting for them to give more elaborate blessings to communicate the dignity of the office they're holding and how they're using that greater office to try to ask for God's blessings for a particular person.
But Paul, I'm going to hope that that was helpful to you and leave it there just because I have time to get more calls in and we're coming up near the top of the hour. But thank you very much. I look forward to talking with you again. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, also listening on the EWTN app. Emma, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So, hey, I'm a grandma again today. Just had a grandson.
Congratulations, Emma.
Yes.
Mazel tov.
Thank you, Mr. Willie. Yep. Anyway, my whole family is going to be with me, all my kids. I got five kids, and all of them are coming home for Christmas, and I'm so excited. Mm-hmm. And I'm really nervous because I'm going to tell them that God has called me into the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'm going to have all my kids and all their wives and husbands looking at me with their jaws open. I know they're going to bring up the scandals, and I just wanted to know, how do you do this with finesse?
Okay, well, I would point out that I would say a few things. Now, you only need to engage them to the extent that you feel comfortable doing so. And you can easily say, look, I love you and I know you have concerns and maybe we can talk about those concerns another time. But since it's Christmas, I didn't want to hide this from you, but I also don't want to get us into a big family discussion of all this right now. So let's celebrate the holidays. Just know that I love you, know that I love God, know that I love Jesus. And we can discuss some of this at another time after the holidays. So let's just try to have a good time together as a family for right now, and we can deal with some of these other issues later on. That would be one way of at least dealing with it in the moment. Now, when it comes time to discuss it, I would point out, yeah, there are scandals in the Catholic Church, as there are in every human organization. And that's because people in every human organization are sinners. And this is not a surprise that there would be scandals. St. Peter himself, the very first pope, denied Christ three times and said, I'm not that man's follower. And nevertheless, Jesus reaffirmed his love for Peter. When Peter repented, he restored him and led him to continue to lead the church. And so having Catholics who have done sinful things is not a surprise, but it doesn't stop them from being legitimate ministers of God, just like St. Peter was a sinner and a legitimate minister of God. Now, we're coming up on a break, and so I don't want to go too much further, but what I would like to do is send you a copy of my book, A Daily Defense. It has 366 different issues, challenges to the faith that it tackles, and this is one of them. Sinful people doing stuff in the church. And so that should give you a good basis for responding preferably after the holidays, to a lot of different concerns that your family might raise. So I hope that helps. Stay on the line. We'll get your information. God bless you. Wonderful to hear about you starting RCIA, and have a wonderful Christmas.
Thank you so much, Emma. We got to take our break, and lines are just full. So I want to encourage those who are on the line, stay on the line. We'll be gone a very brief moment, and then we get to every call in order. And also, there's going to be one line open. So if you want to call now, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. Whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, your call is welcome here. 888-318-7884.